This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back in the hard-traveling L-shaped studio in beautiful and serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, located, of course, in the confines of Hoholoon Plaza. Beautiful this time of year, is it not? And with me is, as always, Nick Duke. I am Greg Phillips, and we are the hard-traveling fanboys. Nick, what a time of year this is. The weather is crisp. The leaves are on the ground and dying in some cases. Snow is falling or not falling. I'm not sure what's happening outside right now here in Vancouver.
Oh, it is very cold here in Vancouver, which is great considering it was in the 70s yesterday in our southern abode. So
very true, very true. And as you know, folks, this is Wing It Month. Wing It Month is continuing, coinciding, appropriately enough, with Winger Month. Nick, what's your favorite Winger song?
My favorite thing, I don't know about any songs, but I remember that Stewart on Beavis and Butthead used to wear a Winger t-shirt.
Oh, so he was a big fan.
That's all I got.
My favorite Winger song would have to be the classic, and I figured you'd pick this one, Nick, given your affinity for CW Leeds. She's only 17. 17. Remember that song?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, Winger did it. Kip Winger is his name. Can you believe a man named Kip Winger was successful?
No, I can't, honestly. What about Kip James?
Kip James. Well, he had to change his name. He never would have gotten over with that name.
Oh. Are you suggesting that the James Gang wasn't over?
The James Gang was not over in TNA, no.
What about the Voodoo Kin Mafia?
Now, that's different. The Voodoo Kin Mafia, as you know, was alluding to someone else. VKM?
Something else.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing right now?
We're getting rowdy, just like Ron the Truth Killings used to do in TNA. But what we're not here to do is talk about TNA. We're not here to talk about the Voodoo Kin Mafia or Kip James or Monty Sopp or anybody like that. We're here to talk about something that we just made up on the fly yesterday afternoon when we decided we needed a topic for this show. It's appropriate for Wing It Month that our topic is Countdown today, which is our always go-to topic when we have nothing else to think of at the moment. And This month, we have decided to deliver unto you a countdown of the top five settings.
Settings or locales.
Locales in the world of comics. Now, what do I mean by settings and locales? Pretty straightforward. You'd have to be an idiot not to understand what a setting is in a book. But that's not true. That's harsh. You might just not understand the verbiage that we're using here. We're referring to any location in comics that is a common recurring place. A city, a state, a realm, a dimension. It could be any number of things that is the location of a comic book series. I'll give you an example that did not make my list. Something like Texas in Preacher would be a setting and an interesting one at that. There are any number of interesting locales in the world of comics. And as we know, Nick, while this is a wing it topic, it is valid in that in many cases, especially over the years and as comics have evolved, the settings can often become characters in and of themselves. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, many creators have said that to an extent. Comic book creators and also directors of films have talked about how various locales can often become characters unto themselves. I think there's one, you know, most major and notable example of that being Gotham City. I know Scott Snyder has talked about that. That was almost a theme of his run from the yes. very jump, is that Gotham itself was a character. And I'm sure we'll have more to say on that at some point in this show.
Or maybe not. You never know, right? I suppose it's possible that both of us put together lists of the top five settings in comics and didn't choose Gotham City.
Yes, it's possible.
Anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation, folks. And what better time than right now, after that segue, to get started with our list. And I'm going to kick us off, Nick. Is that all right?
That's fine with me.
Coming in at number five, I have the first cheat of our list.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Are you ready? Because I'm including a setting that is utilized in both Marvel and DC comics regularly.
And you're counting it as one entry.
I am, as one entry. Okay. And has been used regularly since the 1940s.
Yes.
That setting, Under the Sea. It is Atlantis.
That's my painting.
You're number five too?
Yes, but I'm not cheating, and I'm going specifically with the DC version of Atlantis, but yes.
Excellent. Well, honestly, I really should just go with the DC version of Atlantis because I haven't had much exposure to the Marvel version. Didn't read a lot of Namor or the Submariner comics when I was a kid. However, I have come across it in Avengers stories, particularly in Avengers stories where he's trying to hit on Sue Storm/Richards at various
points.
With
his giant package, of course. Yes,
his overly large package. So over the years, Atlantis has certainly formed a key part in Marvel storytelling through being the kingdom of Namor, who is one of the more aggressive kings in the world of comics. There are times when he decides once in a while, he just decides to invade the surface world. And sometimes he decides that he's tired of the surface world infringing upon him. And sometimes he's a mutant. Sometimes he's a mutant that doesn't get involved in mutant affairs. There's a lot of things going on there and a lot of hierarchy there in the Kingdom of Atlantis in Marvel Comics. Atlantis Attacks is a famous Marvel story involving the Avengers. And it always brings out a litany of interesting characters. Namorita is another famous character from there. They bring in creatures, seahorses, and all kinds of things that you haven't seen before. But what I'm most familiar with is the world of Aquaman, and mm-hmm. that's kind of why it made my list. Atlantis, I think, when you think about it on the surface level, is one thing, and then when you actually delve into the mythology of Aquaman, or of Namor for that matter, you realize that Atlantis is something far different than perhaps what you imagined. I think before the 2011 Geoff Johns Aquaman run, my vision of Atlantis was largely shaped by the cartoons, and it was interesting in the cartoons. Justice League Unlimited had a very interesting take on Atlantis, its underworld kingdom, but I think I didn't really understand the sort of political maneuverings and the hierarchy, and it's almost this totally different world of politics and governance and creatures that are just as interesting as the alien creatures that you'll meet in Green Lantern or in Guardians of the Galaxy or something like that. There are it's almost a retro approach to a government, right? It's very similar to the sort of government you would find in ancient Rome, and how the different parties align themselves and conspire with and against one another. The sense of honor, the sense of duty, the sense of
duty,
the sense of which underwater duty is, as we both know, is always fun, and then just a way of presenting this monarchy, this governance that is interesting, that is compelling, and the settings, these wild palaces that exist leagues under the sea, these gigantic ships and vessels that they use to transport themselves, these odd underwater mammals and fish that they communicate with that pop up, sometimes monstrously so. Or even individuals like the Trench that aren't part of Atlantis but will attack Atlantis and cause problems for them. It's an endlessly fascinating setting, and one that I think under the stewardship of Dan Abnett also became something of a living and breathing character in the Aquaman world. Not that it wasn't in the past, because we've seen that also through the Peter David run, but it's just always fascinating when writers and artists can make a world feel so alive as they do when they get a chance to play in Atlantis, certainly for artists. And so I'll cede the floor to you on this one, Nick.
Yeah, no, I mean, you pretty much laid it out perfectly. Anytime you have an opportunity to create something, a setting that is completely unlike anything we would see in normal everyday life, you know, we love Metropolis and we love Gotham City and we love all these other fictional cities, but each of them essentially reflects aspects of modern American society in their designs. We see things like this in movies and television all the time. This version, you know, the comic book version of Atlantis, specifically in DC, because that's what I'm most familiar with, is something that can be this blank slate that you can almost put just about anything on it. And like you said, we've kind of seen it fleshed out more than ever in recent years between the Geoff Johns run and the Dan Abnett run. Like you said, the architecture and the political structure, but also, especially in the Abnett run, leaning into the idea that Atlantis, while it is a kingdom, is also just a city, and it has the same problems as any other city: poverty, crime, essentially a class system that's in place, mm-hmm. whether intentionally or unintentionally, and getting to see the ramifications of that and kind of what an underwater underworld looks like was really cool. So basically, for the last 7 or 8 years of work, Atlantis finds its way onto my list.
Very good, and certainly a worthy entry on both our lists. Let's see if we keep the synergy alive here with my number four entry, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
At number four, I have the very first and only entry on my list that is literally a living and breathing thing, because my number four selection comes to us from the world of DC Comics, and it is MOGO, the Living Planet Green Lantern. And why did this make my list? Well, to be completely transparent, I was going back and forth, waffling between whether to put MOGO or whether to put OA. And I started thinking on it. And while – oh, go ahead, Nick.
No, you're fine.
And while OA is certainly worthy of a placement on any list, it's an interesting setting that has provided the source of many great stories over the years, and MOGO has been used more recently, I just think there is something endlessly compelling and fascinating about operating on a living creature, about the setting, your entire setting of your story being a living creature. And right now we're seeing that play out in the pages of X-Men with Krakoa. But what's interesting about MOGO is he becomes we don't really know what his deal is, but he becomes this sort of paradise of sorts for Green Lanterns, where Lanterns can go and rest and recuperate and restore their energies. That's what he's kind of used for many years. And then after the destruction of OA, by necessity, he becomes the centerpiece of the Green Lantern Corps. He becomes where everything emerges from, the green light emerges from, the central battery emerges from. He becomes headquarters of the Green Lantern Corps. And so you get we've talked before ad nauseum on this show about why Green Lantern is such an amazing concept that appeals to us so much. And it's because of the diversity. It's because of such a confluence of different alien creatures, big, small, fat, skinny, you know, a variety of powers, all coalescing together, existing alongside one another, and yet standing out from one another because of their differences. Whether it's a mosquito Green Lantern or whether it's a giant robot Green Lantern, they're all valuable to the core. And they are on, they're living inside a Green Lantern itself in MOGO, which Guy Gardner has lived inside many Green Lanterns over the years. But in this case, it is a reciprocal type thing. And MOGO feeds his energy to these people, and it's this lush greenery. But yet when MOGO is under attack, or when the green light is under attack, that reflects itself in MOGO, because you see the trees start to die, the flowers start to wilt, and MOGO almost becomes this apocalyptic planet when its energy is drained. And I think that's, you know, I think back to Blackest Night. I think back to War of the Green Lanterns. I think back to the New 52 Green Lantern and some of the great battles that have been taking place on MOGO. And even in its sort of coming out of that run into the post-Geoff Johns run, where they kind of regrouped around MOGO as the centerpiece of the Green Lantern universe. So many interesting stories told, so many compelling characters interacting here, and MOGO himself becoming one of the fan favorite Green Lanterns, emerging from a short story that Alan Moore wrote back in the 80s. So that's why MOGO makes my list. I agonized leaving Oa off of my list, but I think I made the right call here because of that living sentient aspect of it.
Yeah, I also considered putting Oa on my list because, you know, I wanted some Green Lantern representation, but, you know, to me, the best setting in Green Lantern isn't even necessarily one specific locale, but just kind of the reaches of space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of being out on patrol. I don't know that Oa specifically, you know, is necessarily the best setting in Green Lantern comics, but I did want some representation on there, and so I considered lots of different Green Lantern representations, but I finally settled on, somewhat surprisingly, at number four. While it's not my favorite aspect of Green Lantern, I'm going to go with an Earth-based Green Lantern concept at number four and go with Coast City. And the reason is very simple. We talk about Gotham City most predominantly, or Metropolis, becoming a character unto itself. But in the Geoff Johns run of Green Lantern, which is what we most often refer back to, he did a phenomenal job of giving Coast City its own definitive mm-hmm. personality
yeah.
and setting it apart from all the other fictional cities in the DC universe. In that story, we got to see a city and a populace, a population of people who had been traumatized, who had lost their home many years ago and were trying to put it all back together and trying to find the will to continue. And in doing so, they found their own inspiration in the return of Green Lantern and this really beautiful, somewhat symbiotic relationship or symbiotic relationship between the two was developed. And we, of course, we often reference that beautiful moment near the end of Sinestro Corps War where all the lights in the city are turning on green in support of Green Lantern. And that's what gives Hal that little bit of extra push to push him over the edge and enable him to come away and win the day. So Coast City for years in Green Lantern had just been just a stand-in for any generic, you know, Californian city, essentially. But in the last 10 years, we've seen the city take on its own personality and really set itself apart. So mm-hmm. I'm going Coast City at number four.
Two Green Lantern choices, MOGO and Coast City at number four for the two of us. Interesting indeed. Now we move on to number three. And number three is another one that I wrestled over because there were a couple of choices I considered here. One of which was Opal City from Starman that I ultimately decided to leave off, but would make it if I had a sixth choice here. But I went with one of the most iconic cities in the world of comics. In fact, one could say the oldest fictional city in the world of superhero comics. And I went with Metropolis, the home of Superman, the Man of Steel. And what I love, I think, the most about Metropolis, the city of tomorrow, as it's often referred to in the comics, is the dichotomy that it has with its sister city, Gotham. So as Gotham reflects its hero and is dark and gloomy and gritty, Metropolis reflects its hero, and it's bright, and it's shiny, and it is a beacon unto the world. It has skyscrapers up into the towering into the heavens, much like Gotham does. But unlike Gotham, its skyscrapers are not imposing and intimidating. They have this almost gloss about them, this gleam about them that appeal to people. It is the idealized metropolitan city that people would have looked at in the 1930s at the World's Fair, as this is what the world will look like in the future. It's always on the cutting edge of technology. It's always large rectangles, large circular designs everywhere, and a park with a statue dedicated to its hero. And yet, when you dig below the surface, Metropolis is every bit as nuanced as Gotham, because there are different areas of Metropolis, while you do have the area of Metropolis where you've got the Daily Planet and you've got your smiling newspaper delivery men and all that stuff, almost simultaneously a slice of the 1950s and also a slice of the 2050s, you then have areas like Suicide Slum, where the people are down and out, and it's poverty, and it's despair, and it's crime, it's street-level crime that often escapes the eye of Superman. And it allows you to open the door for stories about how does Superman handle the worst in humanity? How does Superman handle things that he can't fight, like poverty, like hunger, like man's innate desire to destroy himself? And you can tell stories about journalism through this, through the lens of the Daily Planet. They've done that many times through Suicide Slum, through exploring the different areas of Metropolis, that the sub-neighborhoods in Metropolis that pop up along the way, talking about the men and women that inhabit this city, some of whom reflect the ideals of their hero Superman, and some of whom resent those ideals, some of whom view Superman as a fraud, as somebody that towers above them and looks down upon them. And it's very much a city of two extremes. It is Superman's Metropolis versus Lex Luthor's Metropolis. And maybe Intergang's Metropolis thrown in there as well. And really three distinct metropolises that exist and that collide with one another in the best Superman stories. So Metropolis makes this for that simple reason. It creates a living, breathing city that we've seen over the years that both reflects its hero and also provides a foil for its hero, that creates a reflection in some ways of our own reality, that life is not always as simple as we would like it to be, of this is what Metropolis is, this is what Gotham is. And so to me, it was a no-brainer that it had to make my list somewhere. It comes in at number 3.
I assumed it would make your list, and I'm a little bit surprised it didn't rank higher. But moving to my number 3, which is one I assume you knew would make my list, I contemplated pulling the ultimate cheat here, I'm not going to lie, and just saying that all 10 realms should count as one entry.
Very, but I didn't. Very compelling, Nick. Very compelling.
But I didn't do that, and I'm going to go with Asgard. If I have to pick one, I'm going to go with Asgard as my number 3. Mm-hmm. Asgard of the Marvel Universe, of course, home to all the Asgardians, especially Thor and Loki and Odin and Baldur the Brave and the Warriors 3 and the Lady Sif and numerous others.
And I understand the home to Odin Kincannon as well.
No, that's the meatpacking plant. That's in Texas.
But easy mistake to make.
Easy mistake to make indeed. But yes, Asgard. As we were discussing earlier with Atlantis, kind of a similar thing in that throughout its history, we have gotten to see how the political machinations of Asgard. We have gotten to see the infighting and the backstabbing of the royal family. We've gotten to see Odin being a massive dick and playing favorites with his sons and how that affects and reverberates throughout the rest of the kingdom. We get to see all sorts of mythology involving this, not just mythology in terms of what we understand Norse mythology to be, but also what their own versions of mythology are, you know, the prophecies that are foretold, all the weight of the future and the past that hangs upon each character. And also, you can't talk about any of these settings. I mean, they are settings without talking about the visual aspect. I mean, the realm eternal, as depicted by numerous artists, whether it be Assad Ribic in the modern day, Walt Simonson back in the 80s, Jack Kirby when it was first created, all the way up to modern times now with Russell Dodderman and others, it really is one of the most breathtaking settings to behold. It's often depicted with heavy tones of gold. The architecture mm-hmm. of the city is often something to behold. And then also there are times where you get to see, much like Atlantis again, kind of that seedier side, that where, you know, how the less fortunate live in Asgard and the back alleys and the taverns where much merry is made and much ale is consumed. So Asgard has always been a fantastic entry into the Marvel Universe. It lives and breathes. We get to see it. And what's awesome is about the very concept of Thor is you get to update it every so often and do something entirely new and different with it. We've had classic Asgard. We've had Asgardia. We've had new Asgard, you know, the levitating Asgard that hovered over Oklahoma for many years.
Yeah.
All with its different you know, different take and a different little different spin on it while retaining enough elements that are familiar to really make it feel like an Asgard that we can recognize. So Asgard, me, easily one of the top five settings in comics.
Outstanding. And it's interesting, Nick, because you have a lot more exposure to Asgard than I have. So I thought it would have ranked higher on your list than it did. As you talked about for me with Metropolis, and it's interesting because my number two selection is Asgard.
Oh, wow.
Now all of the, and you really, you answered it much more eloquently than I can about why it would make my list, because you've read a lot more Thor comics than I have. But in my limited exposure to Thor, which primarily comes from the Jason Aaron run and from some of the outside media, the movies, the cartoons, etc., Asgard has always been the most compelling aspect about Thor to me. Asgard is endlessly fascinating. I would love to see a Marvel movie, an MCU movie, that never leaves Asgard, that completely takes place on Asgard. I think
that would have been nice.
And is still very funny. Most importantly, but no, I think Asgard is tremendous to read about, to see in action. There are so many beautiful colors. Colors are a big part of Green Lantern. They're a big part of Thor as well. The Rainbow Bridge, the names, the Shakespearean names for everything, the verbiage that are used, the Norse mythology that is incorporated. Again, the hierarchy, the kingdom, the politics, the backstabbing, the soap opera elements that go along with Asgard and the way it operates. Asgard's relationship to the other realms, whether it, you know, probably least compelling of which is Earth, as we talk about a lot with these media. Nick, isn't that crazy that we always find Earth to be the least interesting?
Well, just because it's in every other book, you know. Want these books that can do other things to reach out and do other things.
Correct. And certainly in the case of Thor, Asgard is always there as a every bit the character that any of the other side characters are in Thor's story. And it shapes him, it molds him, and it molds and shapes those around him as well. And like I said, you covered it a lot better than I could hope to. So I'm gonna cede it over to you for your number two selection.
Well, this is one that I assume probably is not going to be on your list, but it's one that it really should find its way onto any list of the top five settings in comics, because it's pretty foundational and transformational in terms of how this city was handled and how it influenced the development of the shared universe and how we all experience that in modern comics today. And I'm speaking, of course, of the only real life city to appear on my list, and that is specifically the Marvel's universe's version of New York City. Because beginning in the 1960s, the early to mid 1960s, with the creation of the Fantastic Four and later Spider-Man, the Avengers, and various other characters, we began to see not just a Marvel universe that was populated with heroes that could all walk and talk and interact with one another, but eventually we began to see most of them were based in New York. And you began to see these hints of how little subtly how things that the Fantastic Four were doing would influence that New York, much in the way, you know, that things Spider-Man was doing. So you would see these little nods to what had just happened in a Spider-Man story over in Fantastic Four. You would see these little nods of what Spider-Man had done in a Spider-Man story. You would see the Sanctum Sanctorum in the backgrounds of some things. You would see the Avengers Mansion in the background of some things. And it really lent this feeling that all of these heroes were living and breathing and occupying the same space. And the fact that it was a real life city made you believe, it kind of brought home that Marvel concept of this is the world outside your door. And over the last, you know, 60 years now, they have continued to add on to that in new and different ways. And yes, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that perhaps they've been too reliant on New York specifically as a locale, but there's just something inherently interesting about getting to see all these heroes occupying this same space and how that affects one another. Without Marvel's version of New York City, the shared universe as we know it would not be quite what we know it as. And so This has to be on my list. No questions asked.
Yeah, I kind of figured this would pop up on your list. It didn't to me because I've always kind of secretly disliked the fact that Marvel is so based around New York City, being a real life city and everything. But I totally understand the importance and the historical significance of it, and the reason why it made your list is certainly valid. It's the linchpin of Marvel, both on the big screen and in the comic books. So it does deserve its respect in that regard. And it's not the comic book New York City's fault that the Yankees, Mets, Knicks, Jets, and Giants all suck.
No, it's not. That's true.
So at number one, I think we've got the exact same painting again here.
It's not even – This was the easiest slam dunk of all time, I think, for a countdown,
for
right?
For a countdown, yep. Other than that one where we said, who are our favorite writers other than Jeff Johns?
Yeah.
But yes, this was a slam dunk. The answer, as anyone could guess, is going to be Midway City.
Yes.
The home of many classic heroes. No, it's of course Gotham City.
Mm-hmm.
The song, the city that spawned a song by noted rapist R. Kelly, and the city that has inspired generations of Bat fans from the 1930s to today. Gotham is, in a word, iconic. It is what I think anyone thinks about when they think about comic book locales, when they think about comic book settings. Because it's a world unto itself. And certainly the reason that we think of it that way owes to many, many, many influential people over the years. It owes to Bob Kane and Bill Finger. It owes to Jerry Robinson. It owes to the 1960s Batman television show with Adam West and Burt Ward as the stars. That certainly breathed life into Gotham City. It owes itself, in the modern context, I think, heavily to the creative mind of Tim Burton. Whose vision and imagination of what Gotham City was shaped everything that came after it, because it influenced the animated series, which influenced our entire generation. Nick and I, our entire generation was influenced by Batman the animated series, aesthetically, creatively, and otherwise. And of course, I left out Frank Miller, who certainly added compelling and necessary elements to Gotham City. And I left out Neil Adams, who certainly brought elements to Gotham City that were not there before. I could read off a litany of incredible and important creators here. Bruce Timm, who brought so much to the world of Gotham City. But the one thing that all these creators have in common, the one thing that all of these stories and these adaptations even that I'm talking about have in common is that they have a city that is alive. And what do we mean by alive? A city that actively enhances the story around it. A city that changes. A city that evolves. A city that can be changed over the course of a story as much as the characters in it have been changed. And a city that indeed shapes the characters around it. We talk a lot about the Scott Snyder run, the Frank Miller run, Jeff Loeb. All of these creators have another thing in common, which is that they all tell stories about the effect that Gotham City has on its residents. How do the everyday men and women that live in Gotham City react to Gotham City? How does the guy who has deemed himself the protector of Gotham City react to Gotham City? In some cases, it changes him for the worse, and in some stories, it changes him for the better. And in some stories, he changes it for the better. But that's ultimately the beauty of Gotham City, is it can be a number of things. It can be a sprawling metropolis, an urban vision of the future to the same degree that Metropolis is. It can also be an urban wasteland, an urban jungle. It can be the worst city you've ever laid eyes on. It can be towering skyscrapers. It can be gritty, grimy department stores with guys carrying Tommy guns around. It can be so many different things. It's a a noir masterpiece. The people that have shaped this city have created this ideal comic book noir location where if you want to tell a gritty story with your character, put them in Gotham. Move them to Gotham for a story arc, and you can see how Superman reacts to being in Gotham City. You can see how Wonder Woman reacts to being in Gotham City. You can see how the Flash reacts to being in Gotham City, and it changes these people, and it alters them. When Dick Grayson became Batman, it changed him having to be the protector, the sole protector of Gotham City, versus when he was doing his own thing. So, to me, this was, as Nick said, a slam dunk. It's a city that gives rise to villains, a city that gives rise to politicians that are corrupt, to a corrupt police force, and also to one of the greatest characters in all of comics in the Caped Crusader, the Dark Knight, Batman. And every version that we've seen on screen has been compelling, even the ones in bad movies.
Yep.
The set designs in Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, even in this TV show Gotham. Gotham City itself was always compelling, even if whatever was around it was not. So it's a slam dunk. It's the best setting in comics. It is the best fictional city in comics. And it's one that will endure beyond our years.
Absolutely. You said it so well. I don't really have much to add there. But, you know, Gotham is a place that is constantly evolving and constantly showing off new sides of itself in story and art and in every facet. One of the great, as I mentioned earlier, one of the great themes of Scott Snyder's run was that Gotham was constantly revealing itself in new ways to even Batman, who thought he knew the city better than anyone, and yet it still had surprises around every corner. And like you said, it's so versatile. You can tell any kind of story in Gotham. If you want to tell a story about poverty and how it affects people, you can tell that story. Mm-hmm. If you want to tell a story about the rich and how high society influences Gotham, you can tell that story. There are any number of population groups you can explore in Gotham City. And much like you said, it's also been adapted so beautifully in pretty much every media it's ever made the transition into. Going back, you know, to Tim Burton's movie in 1989 with that gothic version of Gotham City that still kind of haunts and sticks in your mind even all these years later. Or maybe it was the animated series, which the perfect blend of what was modern sensibilities at 1992 with these more classic sensibilities from the 1950s and 60s, and yet you didn't question that. It kind of all blended together perfectly for that version of Gotham City. Maybe it's the ultra realistic version from Chris Nolan's films that works so well. There really hasn't been a bad Gotham put on the screen yet. Neo Gotham from Batman Beyond is even really cool because it gives you an opportunity to see what that super futuristic version of Gotham might look like. Every version of Gotham we've seen, like you said, even in the bad adaptations or the bad stories, is still at least visually interesting, and that in and of itself, I think, sets it apart from other places. To me, it was a slam dunk. No question, the greatest setting in comics.
Outstanding. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We have given you our choices for the best settings, locations in the world of comic books and comic book media. We want to hear your choices. We want to hear some of the ones we left out. I know Opal City, Hub City from DC would be in there. Midway City would be in there, certainly. Keystone City and Central City in the world of The Flash were certain contenders for this thing. You know,
I have lots of Green Lantern locations I considered. Korrigar, for example.
Yes.
Ismalt was another one I considered. Ward was considered. Apocalypse nearly made my list.
Yeah. Apocalypse was very close to mine as well. I considered putting – I even had a speech ready on that one. But mm-hmm. And then Marvel said the Savage Land. Certainly. I'm not a huge Savage Land guy.
Wakanda.
A lot of people love it. Wakanda, certainly. Absolutely Wakanda. And there are so many great settings out there. So we want to see those lists. Hit us up on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. And you can, of course, join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and comment, assuming I remember to share this podcast, which I didn't do last week and need to do now, actually. And in the meantime, we are going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we'll have the rundown, and that'll be about it. So we'll catch you on the other side of this break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Nick,
that's a little bit of radio voice, Greg. I always like when that makes it appear.
You're listening to WTBF. This is Greg Phillips, WTBF. That was my reporter voice, radio reporter voice from college.
The Brundage City Council.
Yeah. Big news today in Brundage. The Brundage City Council passed an ordinance disallowing weeds to be grown in town. When reached for comment, Councilmember Lawrence Bowden said, "Huh? This is Greg Phillips, WTBF."
God, that's more accurate than people could believe, probably.
Well, it's that time once again, folks. It's that time to tell you all about the PN news and notes in the world of comic books and comic book media. It's a segment known across the Philippines as The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to The Rundown.
Well, let's start us off here on the rundown with this first story that we've got here on our list. It's a very short rundown this week. By the way, our shows are going to be very short during this holiday season, as they often are. So,
yes,
Shazam 2. You know, we had talked about this on the show, Nick, or I was a little worried about not hearing any news about Shazam 2. Well, we finally got some news on Shazam 2. It is currently scheduled for an April 1st, 2022 release date. This would, of course, be in keeping with DC's recent schedule of 4 years between sequels instead of three. And this will give us the cast returning. As far as we know, everybody is signed up to return. And interestingly enough, Nick, at least if the schedule keeps, Shazam 2 will open just over 3 months after the December 22nd, 2021 debut of Dwayne The Rock Johnson's Black Adam movie. Coincidence?
No, can't be a coincidence. I wouldn't think, anyway.
I agree. I think that could very well be our first meeting of Shazam and Black Adam, and that should be an explosive combination. You excited to see a sequel to the Zachary Levi vehicle?
Absolutely. I enjoyed Shazam, as I mentioned, when it aired, and when it released, and when we had our Shazam month and our review of the film. Thought it was a lot of fun. Looking forward to a sequel.
Indeed. And speaking of nothing that we were just talking about, there's really no way to transition that I could easily think of, but speaking of superheroes that wear trunks in the comics, DC is celebrating Robin's 80th anniversary. And this is something of a trend at DC Comics recently with big anniversary celebrations for its heroes. We've seen the Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman get these big celebrations. Well, now Robin, the first prominent superhero sidekick, is getting his celebration, his moment in the sun. It will pay tribute. The Super Spectacular book is paying tribute not just to the original Robin, Dick Grayson, although it should, quite frankly. This should entirely be about Dick Grayson and no one else. But instead, it's also celebrating Jason Todd, Tim Drake, Damian Wayne, Stephanie Brown, Carrie Kelly, and all the other Robins that we have seen across media. On March 11th, DC will debut the Robin 80th Anniversary 100-page Super Spectacular, done in an anthology format similar to the recent Action Comics 1000 and Detective 1000. And talk about an all-star creative team. They always get them for these big books, Nick, and they got another one here for some of the most influential and important Robin creators over the years. Unfortunately, the original creators of Robin are long deceased, but we do get Marv Wolfman, Tom Grummett, Chuck Dixon, Scott McDaniel, Devin Grayson, Dan Jurgens, Norm Rapmond, Tim Seeley, Tom King, Mikel Janin, James Tynion IV, Peter J. Tomasi, and Judd Winnick. And they will be joined by pinups from artists such as Kenneth Rocafort, Nicola Scott, Andy Kubert, and Frank Miller. So, that was a bloody mouthful. We should also mention the decade.
I hope Frank Miller's pinup is of Dark Knight Strikes Again, Dick Grayson.
Yes, that would certainly be the hope. The decade by decade variant covers are one of the coolest parts about these anniversary books, I think. And we will get one from Jim Lee and Scott Williams for the 1940s, Julian Totino Tedesco for the 1950s, Dustin Nguyen for the 1960s, Kari Andrews for the 70s, Frank Miller, of course, for the 80s, Jim Chung for the 90s, Derek Chu for the 2000s, and Yasmin Putri for the 2010s. What do you think about this project? What are some of the things you might be looking forward to in this one?
I think it's really cool, obviously. It's cool to see Robin being given something of the same treatment that Batman and Superman most recently received in, like you said, Action 1000 and Detective 1000. For these, though, the real draw is always the creative teams. I'm interested to see who the artists are that will be pairing with the writers on the individual stories. But just based on the list of writers, I mean, you got to be pretty excited about Tom King, James Tynion IV, Peter Tomasi, Judd Winnick, I mean, Marv Wolfman, Chuck Dixon, all these guys who kind of had definitive takes. I mean, Chuck Dixon is considered to be the definitive Tim Drake writer. You'd have to think he's going to do something involving Tim
yes.
Drake.
Judd Winnick, for my money, wrote the best
Jason Todd story of all time. So you would hope he would have something to do with Jason Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Tomasi is probably the best Damian writer we've seen.
Yep.
Tom King is very, very skilled at writing the adult Dick Grayson. So, I mean, I'm just interested to see what these stories are and who the artists will be paired with and which characters they're going to be writing on.
Oh, absolutely. It's endlessly compelling. Stephanie Brown is in the mix too. Certainly was written in stories by Judd Winnick. It was written by Devin Grayson. So going to be some interesting stuff to be found here. We always look forward to these big anniversary books. And just think of what's going to happen here in a couple years when we get a Green Lantern one, Nick.
No.
Going to be good. Well,
sadly, that won't be happening for some time, though.
True.
Unless we're getting an Alan Scott.
Hey, we could. 80th anniversary. Celebration of the concept. Well, I haven't watched it. Neither has Nick. But Watchmen on HBO has been quite the sensation. It's been getting critical and audience acclaim. It's the most watched cable television show of 2019. Huge success for Damon Lindelof and his crew. And a report came out that, it was supposed to be a one-and-done project, but Lindelof says that following the well-received season one finale, he is open to the idea of future seasons that he may or may not be involved in. He says HBO does want the series to continue, but at this time he doesn't have any formative ideas for what it would be, and he's saying that every idea that he had went into this season. And You know, he's also suggested in an interview that he would like to see someone that's not a white guy take over show running if they do a sequel in the future. So he says, I could see, you know, I want to see, maybe it'll continue in a year or two, maybe they'll continue it in 4 years, but I want to see more Watchmen. I always said to them, I see Watchmen as Fargo, as True Detective. They were ongoing anthology shows, but each season had a design with a beginning, middle, and end that allowed subsequent seasons to feature entirely different characters and even be set in different time periods. So, Nick, what are your thoughts? We don't really have educated thoughts on this because we haven't seen the show. We were and probably still are very skeptical about it. But what are your thoughts on the idea of more?
Well, it's been well received by, I mean, virtually every person who we know that has watched it has enjoyed it.
Yes.
So if people are enjoying it, if HBO is happy with it, and if Lindelof as the showrunner is open to more, and importantly, if Dave Gibbons is willing to sign off on more, then why not? Like, you know, this is not going to take away from you or I enjoying the comic. I don't think we can still go on pretending that this, if by some chance we watch this and hate it, we can still go on pretending that it never happened. Like, the comic will still always be there for us. Comic Book Theater, the first two installments of the uncompleted audio adaptation, will always be there for us. So, you know, more power to them. If people are enjoying it, why not?
Absolutely. To quote the Judds, why not me? It doesn't really fit there, does it?
Well, no.
The Michael Cole, like, well, no. Well, you know, speaking of Michael Cole, Nick, I think that I can't help but look at the iPod Touch that's sitting over here next to my computer for some reason, and on the iPod Touch, it's got a little clock on there, you know, a little thing that tells you the time, and it says to me that the time is here for the Wrestling Minute. So, Nick, what's been going on in the world of wrestling? It's caught your eye.
Well, we had a pay-per-view, a TLC pay-per-view.
It sure did.
It was okay, I guess. It had its ups, it had its downs, had an unfortunate injury in the main event that kind of derailed what I thought was had a pretty solid opening to a good match and a match that had a lot of potential, if not for the injury. But, you know, there you are. And then they followed it up with what I thought was a pretty bad Raw, as has become the norm.
Yes, although I will say there were things to enjoy about Raw. I really liked the Seth Rollins new character that appears to be Negan-inspired in some ways. I really liked Becky Lynch. I thought cut one of the best promos she's cut all year on Monday night, selling me on a match against Asuka and showing a rare vulnerability in WWE babyfaces in a promo. I thought that was tremendous. And I thought the main event was excellent between AJ Styles and Randy Orton, an old-school style match that is kind of rare in this age. Feels like Orton is good to bust one of those out every 6-7 months or so. It just feels different from the kind of matches we get every week now in televised wrestling. So I enjoyed that main event greatly. But overall, yeah, the show had a lot of listless things happening in it. But some good stuff thrown in. Kira Tozawa, push that man. Give that man something to sink his teeth into. He's really good. And then AEW, I don't know if you've watched any of that last week. I think you were tied up. But AEW, I thought, had one of its strongest episodes last week. I thought that was the best episode of AEW since probably week four, maybe, and very, very strong stuff across the board. Good main event. None of the matches were like match of the year contenders or anything like that, but there's just good, solid wrestling matches. Great promo with Jericho, you know, on commentary, rather. Great commentary from Jericho and Hager kicking Excalibur and Tony out of the booth because, quote, Schiavone's been on my case for 20 years now. So it's they're really doing a great job of building Jungle Boy for his non-title match against Jericho. I've really enjoyed the tag division and how that's coming together. A lot of great tag teams in AEW right now. And, yeah, they're doing a good job with the show. And then NXT continues to roll along and kick ass, take names. Real excited for this week's NXT. This is going to be the first week, Nick, that I think I'm going to watch NXT live and watch AEW after the fact because I'm stoked for that title match between Adam Cole and Finn Balor.
and also the Rhea Ripley Shayna Baszler women's title match.
They're both on the same show. That's right.
That we are assuming will main event the show, since we know that Cole and Balor is opening the show.
Yes, so. And we may sound like fools by the time this comes out, but both of us think that Rhea Ripley is taking home the gold on this show.
Yes, that is my assumption.
Well, with that said, that has been. Oh, there's one other thing we should mention, Nick.
What's that?
We are right in the midst of planning for WrestleMania season. Isn't it good?
It is good. We mentioned this last week. It's exciting. We've acquired our NXT TakeOver Tampa tickets, and I have acquired my solo Hall of Fame ticket to go see the New World Order and Hollywood Hogan inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame.
Do you think it's possible that Soul Train Jones still manages to get on stage at some point?
One can only hope. One can only hope. There really should be at least some sort of like they should do like a
in memoriam
video montage of like all the different members from throughout the
yeah and play that badass NWO B team porno music.
Yes.
Boo, boo, ba-do-do-do-do,
you know,
New World Order.
Horace Hogan.
Horace.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Get the voiceover guy to come back.
Yes.
And read the names.
New World Order. VK Wall Street.
Scott Norton.
Vincent.
Stevie Ray.
Buff Bagwell. Yeah.
This is awesome. This is a good idea.
It's an excellent Ron and Don Harris.
Now if they really want to set it apart, they need to have Hogan, Paul, Nash, and I guess Waltman standing there doing their induction speech while Bret Hart sits on the turnbuckle in the corner and just looks and nods.
I'm good with it. And occasionally smirks.
And occasionally smirks, yeah.
Essentially, 1998, we discovered this on our Talking WCW podcast. 1998, Bret Hart was in many ways the precursor to Orange Cassidy.
He just sat there. Shades on, nodding.
Yes, this is all good stuff. Oh, and we're also in the midst of discussions for an AEW show in Hotlanta, Nick. You ready for that?
I suppose so. We have to figure out all the logistics of that. It is middle of the week, which makes it a little bit trickier, but I'm sure we can overcome that given the proper motivation. So that's something to consider.
Where there is a will, there's a way, they say.
Indeed.
Well, that is about all that we've got for you here on this. Gosh, is this the last episode before Christmas, Nick?
No, we have – well – this is the last episode people will hear before
right.
Christmas. You and I
yes.
will not to tell tales out of school, but we'll record one more before Christmas.
Oh my gosh, Nick! What the hell is that?
That's the Ho Ho Loon ticker.
Oh, you're right there. Oh my gosh! Look at this piece of paper here. There's so much shit on here. What does this even mean? Okay. All right. I have an announcement. May I have your attention, please? I have received an announcement through the anonymous Ho Ho Loon ticker, and it states, Ho Ho Loon's biographical information still available on the award-winning WWE Network. Wow. What great news in time for the holidays, Nick.
Yes, indeed. Oh, man. I really want this Conrad rejected t-shirt now, the dinner circle.
I saw that earlier. Got to get me some Conrad shirts for the trip.
I know.
Well, anyway, that's about all the time we have for you, folks.
Indeed it is, except, you know, last week I know we broke many people's hearts. Good old JR was feeling a little under the weather, wasn't able to perform last week, but in the spirit of the Christmas season.
I think we told
him
it was a travel issue last week, but okay. Sure.
Sick travel issue, whatever we told him. We lie either way. The point being, he's back this week. And the you know, we just lied. It was bullshit.
It was bullshit.
But this week he's back. And in honor of the Christmas season, I thought it would be best to have JR do a little rendition of one of my favorite Christmas tunes, and JR, it may be a song with which you're familiar, and I'm looking forward to hearing your own unique version of this particular song.
Well, first of all, again, thank you, Conrad. I appreciate your time.
Once more, I am not Conrad Thompson.
Well,
I am not married to a Flair.
I am not wealthy, and I am not as fat as Conrad Thompson.
Well, I don't know who you're trying to fool, me or my lying eyes, but nonetheless, I am familiar with this song, Nick. I'm familiar with this song's artist. You may not know this, but back in the early 1980s, I was working for Cowboy in Mid-South Wrestling, and we used to get a visit from a gentleman named Clarence Carter. And he used to come into the arena, and during the middle of a match, be holding a headlock or applying a hold. You don't grab a hold, folks. You don't grab a hold. You apply a hold. Somebody be applying a headlock, and out of nowhere, you'd hear this man in the back of the arena, and he'd start shouting, "Clarence Carter, Clarence Carter, Clarence Carter." And sure enough, do you know who it was, Nick?
It was Clarence Carter?
It was Clarence Carter. And anyway, he did this song back in the 1960s, a little album called Soul Christmas. And I bought that album when I was a young JR. I begged my mother to buy it for me, and she did. Well, it goes a little something like this. Do, 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 do. Oh, yeah. Do, 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 do. Well, they call me Backdoor Santa. I make my runs about the break of day. They call me Backdoor Santa. And why? Because I make my runs about the break of day. I make all of the little girls happy while the boys are out to play. Boys are going to be boys, Nick. Very simple. Now, I ain't like old Saint Nick over here. He don't come but once a year. I ain't like old Saint Nick. He don't come but maybe once, twice a year. Boom. I come running with my presents every time you call me dear. Now, an interesting thing is I didn't get paid much now when I was in the territory days. Now, I had a promoter that would just pay me in hot dogs. I would. I keep some change in my pocket just in case the children are home. In that case, I'll give them a few pennies, maybe a hot dog and a Coke, so that we can be alone. I leave the back door open so if anybody smells a fart. And wouldn't old Santa be in trouble if there ain't no chimney in your house? Well, the reason is they call me Backdoor Santa. Why? I make my runs about the break of day. I make all of those little girls happy while the boys are out on the town. They're going to bars, they're drinking, they're gambling, they're fornicating. Boys are going to be boys. But that's what they call me, is Backdoor Santa. Now, damn it, they call me Backdoor Santa. That is what all of the women call me. I give them all little presents, a little barbecue sauce, little bacon, a little bit of that the jerky. The JR jerky is real good. Give them a little bit of steak, a little bit of potatoes, a little bit of Moscow mules. I give them all these presents, and then that's what they call me. They call me the Backdoor Santa. And I like it, by God. I like it when they call my ass Backdoor Santa. I like it, and I like it, and I like it.
Our traveling fanboys.